myself on my career path.
I was not offered the job, which was fine because working for the state party or any explicitly partisan organization
was not where my main interest was. Soon thereafter, I headed off to Wichita Falls, Texas, to manage my first campaign, the Texas State Senate race, for a man who would later become my friend, Tom Haywood. It was not until I met with Karen in late 1998 for the position she was looking to fill in Governor Bush's communications office that I really got to know her. I thought highly of her abilities as a communicator, and I liked her take-charge style and dynamic personality. Karen mentored me in political communication. I had a good base of knowledge to begin with, having grown up with a mother who occupied the local political spotlight and then later serving as a campaign manager and spokesman in her successful statewide campaigns. The latter role caught Karen's attention. Once I was on the job, I found that she followed what Bush's spokespeople said very closely. If she felt it could be stated more strongly, more cautiously, or more reflectively of Bush's tone and style, she would let the spokesperson know. She viewed her job as making sure spokespeople adhered to her and Bush's style and tone of communication. They were one and the same. I honed my communication skills under her direction. But Karen's communication strength was in some ways her weakness. Though well-liked, she was viewed by many in the media as overzealous at times in her devotion to Bush. She was at times too disciplined, a communicator form, always on message, always emphasizing the positive, always downplaying the negative, always protective of Bush, and rarely, if ever, giving an inch. But that's exactly how Karen and Bush wanted it. Having come from the media, Karen knew the media always tended to seek the limelight and controversy, especially in the high-stakes, competitive national environment. She was not going to hand them anything to exploit. Message control required great discipline in Karen's and Bush's minds. And spokespersons who could not be pulled off message, like Karen, were highly valued. In her capacity as counselor to the president, Karen initially had purview over four offices and later added a fifth, global communications. The communications office was responsible for strategic communications planning, looking a week to 2 weeks down the road, and for execution of the overall strategy. It was the central office for coordinating Bush's message throughout the White House and the administration. And it was the office responsible for making sure that the picture of the day reinforced the message and image of Bush that we sought to portray. I'm referring here to a literal picture, which was carefully planned in the hopes that it would end up above the fold in the next day's newspapers or prominently featured on the evening news, from a simple picture of Bush greeting soldiers if the day's theme was military preparedness, to the elaborately choreographed scene of Bush speaking in front of the Statue of Liberty on the anniversary of 9/11. Reagan's team had perfected this art of stagecraft, and the man in charge for Bush, Deputy Communications Director Scott Sforza, took it to new heights. The Office of the Press Secretary was a round-the-clock operation that focused on the National and White House Press Corps and handled daily media relations with them, conducting daily briefings and being the chief spokesman for the White House. There was close coordination with other communicators, but the press secretary had plenty of autonomy to run the office as he saw fit.
When I became press secretary, the role was to faithfully articulate the president's views, decisions, and policies, and publicly advocate for and defend them with the national media.
The Office of Media Affairs focused on local media across the United States and daily media relations. The media affairs team responded to inquiries from the local media outlets, helped coordinate with those outlets when the president traveled to their respective areas, and was responsible for coordinating presidential interviews with local reporters. The Office of Speech Writing was responsible for churning out countless presidential speeches and remarks. The speechwriting process played a vital role in driving policy. Drafts of speeches would be circulated to all relevant White House offices, including the president's senior advisors and specific policy advisors. The president had the final say, but if an advisor wanted to influence policy, the speechwriting process was one way to do so. In addition to her abilities as a communicator, Karen had a strong force of personality and a keen understanding of the more traditional political views of middle America, as well as where the broad majority in the center usually comes down on an issue. Both attributes benefited Bush greatly. Karen had her own assertive and imposing presence within the White House. She was not afraid to assert her views in meetings or go directly to the president privately. She also had a good grasp of how to connect with everyday Americans and help the president better communicate his policies and decisions and set the right tone with them. Just as important, Karen provided a good counterbalance to Karl Rove. He had strong beliefs about the way things should be done. So did Karen. While Karl's views were oriented largely around the conservative base, Karen's focused on everyday Americans toward the center of the political spectrum. The differences were less over policy than over tone, message, policy framing, and public emphasis.
The two worked well together, but were not shy about disagreeing openly in front of the president.
It was what one would expect from two strong-willed, opinionated, and knowledgeable individuals who both had the full and extraordinary confidence of the president. The third member of the White House troika was Andy Card, a tireless public servant who brought years of experience to his position as chief of staff. His sphere of influence was built on both his position and his closeness to the president. Though he was more of a facilitator for the president, noticeably less domineering and softer spoken than either Karl or Karen. His role was to serve as an honest broker among the staff inside the White House and help make sure all views were heard, while privately offering his views to the president as needed and appropriate, usually once the policy process had time to work its course. Andy understood how Washington and the White House operate, since he had served both Reagan and the president's father. He also understood the unparalleled trust Bush placed in Rove and Hughes, and how much he valued their viewpoints. Andy worked to make sure the policy processes ran their full course and that staffers felt included in them. He managed the president's most valued commodity, his time, in part by making sure that people saw the president only when they really needed to. Most notably, Andy managed and oversaw the White House exactly the way Bush preferred, firmly, with discipline, focus, and thoughtful, deliberate planning. When Bush required it, Andy kept the administration compartmentalized in a way that restricted information to a select few. I first met Andy on the campaign trail back in 2000. My recollection is that it was ahead of the Republican convention, which he had been tapped to oversee. He came across as a very likable person, courteous and dignified, but I did not really get to know him until we worked together in the White House. Toward the end of the transition, just ahead of the inaugural, Andy assembled all of the staffers who would be working in the West Wing. Most, like me, had never worked in the White House before. We listened intently as he talked about what we should expect and what he expected of us. He talked about the honor of working there. He stressed the importance of working together as a team. We were all there to serve the president. He talked about the importance of humility, not letting our jobs go to our head. He talked about the intensity of working there. And he let us know that the average tenure of someone who works in the West Wing is about 2 years. He told us to remember to know when it is time to leave. He cited the example of John Sununu, chief of staff to the first President Bush, who had failed to recognize when it was time to go until it was forced upon him. It was hard to appreciate what he was saying then, but after serving in the White House, I understood his remarks much better. One can become too comfortable inside the bubble. When that happens, one's perspective becomes stale and one's energy is drained. Burnout can set in. A president needs change, fresh perspectives, and new energy from his staff. That's why turnover is important and, when correctly timed, a very beneficial process. Of course, Rove, Hughes, and Card weren't the only powerful figures in the Bush White House. Two other prominent advisors at the beginning were the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, and the Vice President, Dick Cheney. Rice, who mentored Bush on foreign policy, was the person whose advice the president relied on most when it came to national security issues starting during the presidential campaign.
Lacking a deep background in foreign policy, Bush counted on a team of foreign policy heavyweights with diverse expertise to help him formulate policy based on his guiding principles, such as freedom, a strong military, and free trade. Rice headed the group, referred to as the Vulcans. It included Richard Armitage, Colin Powell's alter ego, Paul Wolfowitz and Steve Hadley, two proteges of Dick Cheney, Richard Pearl, Bob Blackwell, Bob Zelick, a James Baker protege, and Dov Zakheim. George Shultz was often called on for advice, and once Dick Cheney became the vice presidential nominee, he too was directly involved. The name of the group was based on the imposing statue of Vulcan, the Roman god of fire and metalworking that is a landmark in Rice's hometown of Birmingham, Alabama.
Bush developed a strong personal bond with Rice and came to trust her judgment, instincts, and insights. As Hughes and Bush's style and tone of communicating were one and the same, so too were Rice's and Bush's views on foreign policy. From the beginning, the president wanted the vice president and his staff included in his White House processes and operations. Dick Cheney and his key advisors were considered integral members of the team. Bush valued Cheney's experience and knowledge, particularly on national security matters, and sought his counsel. At the same time, Cheney and his advisors essentially ran their own operation, as I will discuss later in this book. Bush and Cheney's relationship was close and substantially private. Cheney tended to offer his counsel in private to the president. He or his top advisors were included in all presidential policy briefings, world leader meetings, congressional meetings, and the like. Of course, Cheney heavily influenced foreign policy. He also took particular interest in economic policy, especially tax and energy issues. Bush showed Cheney great deference, especially when he designated him to take on a specific task, such as heading the Energy Task Force early in the administration, or bird-dogging buy-in from congressional leaders on the controversial warrantless wiretapping program instituted after 9/11. Bush also relied on Cheney's ability to shape what Bush considered vital national security policies on matters such as al-Qaeda detainees. But it was the troika of Rove, Hughes, and Card, especially Rove, who drove the permanent campaign inside the Bush White House, embracing and emulating the manipulative political and communication tactics used by Bush's predecessor that had put off many Americans. It was all done through carefully orchestrated campaigns to shape sources of public approval to Bush's advantage, such as the ones developed to advance tax cuts, education reform, and the selling of the war in Iraq. At least in the early days of the presidency, the troika and the structure of the White House served Bush well. While Cheney declared in early 2001 that the days of the war room and the permanent campaign are over, the reality was far from it. The permanent campaign was simply being restructured, redefined, and expanded to how it best suited the Bush White House. Permanent campaign-style methods proved highly successful as the early Bush White House sold two high-priority agenda items to the public and got them passed in Congress. These early successes may have contributed to the air of invincibility that set in, leaving the administration vulnerable to the mistakes that later damaged the Bush presidency. Chapter 6, The Early Days. The first 6 months after Bush took office on January 20, 2001, would be a crucial time for defining the president and his administration. Bush and his top advisors recognized the importance of achieving some early victories on signature policy items, especially tax cuts and education reform. They also wanted to portray the new president as a strong leader who could unite the American people and who had the necessary heft in foreign policy, one notable area of concern about Bush's leadership ability. At the same time, the tone set by the new administration would also be of great importance. Most Americans were more than ready for a return to civility in the national political discourse. They were weary of the excessive partisanship of the previous decade, ready to move beyond Bill Clinton's personal scandals, and exhausted by the extended 2000 election period. But whether Washington was prepared to respond by working together in a spirit of bipartisan cooperation remained uncertain. During the campaign, Bush had tapped into the mood of the broad majority of Americans who were in or who leaned toward the vital political center. He had urged an end to the politics of anger and the beginning of a fresh start after a period of cynicism. Washington, Bush said, did not have to be a place of zero-sum politics with one winner and one loser. Now, at the outset of his presidency, it seemed to me that Bush was committed to making it happen. In his inaugural address, Bush returned to this campaign theme. America, at its best, matches a commitment to principle with a concern for civility. A civil society demands from each of us goodwill and respect, fair dealing, and forgiveness. Some seem to believe that our politics can afford to be petty because in a time of peace, the stakes of our debates appear small. But the stakes for America are never small. We must live up to the calling we share. Civility is not a tactic or a sentiment. It is the determined choice of trust over cynicism, of community over chaos. And this commitment, if we keep it, is a way to shared accomplishment. No one in the White House,
including me, was naive about the difficulty of ending Washington's deep-seated partisan warfare in those early days. But I believed Bush was willing to make a concerted, sustained effort to rise above the destructive partisan squabbling and the distractions created by the Washington noise machine. Unfortunately, it would turn out otherwise. And looking back on the inner workings behind the White House's public performance during these early months, I've come to better understand some of the factors that would later contribute to the Bush presidency's veering off course. Those first few weeks were a flurry of chaotic activity. Everything was happening at once. I moved into my small downtown apartment halfway between the Capitol and the White House over inaugural weekend. The demands of transitioning into the White House as the principal deputy press secretary gave me little time to enjoy all the festivities. Like many others, I'd just packed up my belongings at the transition office the day before. In order to allow time for a quick cleaning and makeover, Joe Hagan, the new deputy chief of staff for operations, had suggested we wait until late Sunday before entering our West Wing offices. When I first stepped foot inside the building, a box of my personal belongings in my hands, it was definitely a moment when I was wowed. There would be many others during those first few weeks of the Bush administration, including when I drove home late at night after a long day of work in the West Wing, taking E Street along the South Lawn side of the White House. I glanced to my left, and there was the White House, the People's Mansion, glowing in the soft yellow radiance of the floodlights against the blackness of a Washington night. The sight never got old. On Monday, our first full workday, we hit the ground running. I was up at 5 a.m., reading the New York Times and Washington Post, the two newspapers that more than any others dictated the direction of the national media and shaped the national storylines. Then it was off to the White House, where I arrived before 7 a.m. There were a few early meetings to discuss press issues of the day and message strategy, followed by the press secretary's morning press gaggle and the afternoon briefing, the two public sessions that would become focal points of the day in my new role. The cycle quickly became routine, but never less than demanding, and never dull. Even at the outset, Iraq was looming in the background. That very first Monday, the New York Times, citing a new internal U.S. government intelligence estimate, ran a front-page story about Iraq rebuilding factories that the United States has long suspected of producing chemical and biological weapons, according to senior government officials. The Times called it an early test of Bush's pledge to take a tougher stance against Saddam Hussein than his immediate predecessor had. Iraq would continue to be a top issue of administration focus and media interest in months to come. The National Security Council made Iraq an early priority of the policy formulation process. As for that first day, with no new policy yet firmly in place, we simply told the press that the president expected Saddam Hussein to live up to his agreement with the United Nations that his regime not produce weapons of mass destruction. That same day, Bush issued a presidential memorandum addressed to the administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, instructing that the so-called Mexico City policy be reinstated. This policy, originally put in place by Ronald Reagan, stated that any non-governmental organization, NGO, receiving USAID funding could not perform or actively promote abortion as a method of family planning, with exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. It was an early signal to the president's social conservative base that his administration was strongly committed to supporting their causes. As planned, the president focused publicly on education reform in week one. We began the formal rollout on Tuesday, hitting the main elements of the initiative, including the requirement that states develop their own systems of annual testing to measure student progress, the increased flexibility provided in spending federal money, the provision of additional assistance for low-income schools, and the principle of offering school choice for students in schools deemed to be failing. Plenty of attention was paid to showing that the president was reaching out to Republican and Democratic members of Congress. The Congress was closely divided, but both houses were controlled by Republicans. The Senate was split 50-50, but Vice President Cheney had the tie-breaking vote, giving Republicans control, though they agreed to a power-sharing arrangement with Democrats. In the House, the breakdown was 221 Republicans to 211 Democrats, with two independents. Due to a handful of deaths and resignations, the numbers would fluctuate ever so slightly in the coming months. In the early weeks, Bush held a series of meetings with leaders in both parties to discuss top domestic priorities, including education, tax relief, his faith-based initiative, and a patient's Bill of Rights, what Bush termed front-burner issues. We made a point of drawing attention to the bipartisan outreach. My first White House trip with President Bush was to the retreat for Democratic House members, held at a resort just outside Pittsburgh the first weekend in February. Bush had already attended the Senate's Democratic retreat. Clinton had never attended Republican retreats, so the move was given due notice in the media and credit for its bipartisanship by Democratic leaders. The event was not open to the press. The president began his remarks at the retreat by saying, "I'll do my best to change the tone of the dialogue in Washington. It is my hope that people can disagree in an agreeable way. One of the things I resolve to do is say, here's my position. I want to hear you out. Bipartisanship is going to require more than words to put forth good public policy, and I believe we're all here to do that." Then he added, "I ran on an agenda. That's what I'm here to talk to you about. I believe the right thing to do is to do what you said you were going to do during the campaign. The expectation is that nothing will get done because of the closeness of the election," he added, making it clear that he intended to prove that expectation wrong. "Part of coming here today is to tell you who I am and about my agenda and listen to what you have to say." He then took several questions. The respected elder congressman Charlie Rangel of New York said in his unique voice, raspy yet oddly captivating, "Mr. President, you're good." He then remarked that it took a lot of political courage for Bush to come to the retreat and reach out to Democrats, and asked whether Bush would urge his party leaders to work across the aisle too. Bush replied that he was committed to taking the same message of civility to the Republican leadership. A few years later, I would hear Rangel, then minority ranking member of the powerful Ways and Means Committee, more than once express his appreciation to the president for bringing leaders of both parties to the White House, followed by complaints that Bill Thomas, the Republican chairman of the committee, had failed to follow suit, giving Democrats little voice in the committee's deliberations. As for the retreat, it was a cordial meeting, but it was difficult to tell whether Democrats were genuinely open to a bipartisan effort and believed in Bush's sincerity. Some were still upset about the Florida recount process, including one speaking for the Congressional Black Caucus. They pressed Bush to act on electoral reform in tones that reflected an underlying tension. But among the leadership and most of the attendees, there appeared to be a willingness, though tempered by skepticism, to see whether the president was going to govern to the center and take into account the concerns of Democrats. Much of the first 6 months had been planned in advance by the president's senior advisors, almost the way a smart head coach will script the first dozen plays of a football game. Controlling the agenda in Washington meant keeping the focus on the big picture, even while reacting to the daily news and responding to the unexpected. Karl Rove understood this well, and he drove the strategic planning efforts with input from a number of top White House aides, particularly Karen Hughes, Andy Card, and Condi Rice. One of the ways we tried to set the agenda was by having a theme of the week around which most of the president's public schedule would center. 1 week, he would do education events, appearing at schools and speaking with groups of teachers and parents. Another week, he would focus on tax cuts, meeting with tax families and small business owners to highlight how much they would benefit from his tax cut plan, much as he'd done during the election campaign. Another week, he focused on defense and made his first trip to a military base, Fort Stewart in Georgia, to talk about his initiative for better pay and housing for troops, followed by an event promoting military transformation to address new threats in the post-Cold War era, a key foreign policy priority during the campaign. It was all part of our well-choreographed plan to get the president off to a quick start and define him as a strong leader focused on redeeming his campaign promises and getting things done. I was spending my early days becoming a part of the White House policy, legislative, and communication operations. I got my fill of meetings. Legislative strategy meetings to discuss important initiatives, daily communications meetings held by Karen Hughes, pre-briefings with my immediate boss, R.A. Flesher, ahead of senior staff, the morning gaggle and the afternoon briefing, twice-a-week message meetings to coordinate the president's upcoming public events, and policy meetings on specific domestic issues, including the Patient's Bill of Rights, campaign finance reform, racial profiling, the environment, Medicare, stem cell research, and education. My fellow deputy, Claire Buchan, and I split responsibilities by issues. Claire took most of the economic issues, and I took most of the other domestic issues, while the National Security Council press office handled foreign policy. We made sure all issues were covered for the press secretary, preparing talking points for him and helping him stay on top of the issues to avoid surprises in the briefing room. When I filled in for Ari, I would of course have to focus more broadly. At times, I would also attend presidential meetings in Ari's place, including congressional meetings and policy briefings. In addition to reaching out to members of Congress from both parties, the president also reached out to key world leaders. It was an effort to show the president engaging in personal diplomacy aimed at strengthening our alliances abroad. Bush's ability to establish strong personal relations with allies was important to highlight, given his very limited experience in foreign policy. As deputy press secretary, my duties also included traveling on selected presidential trips. Whenever a president travels, he is accompanied by a virtual traveling White House, including advisors, support staff, Secret Service agents, and military staff. The White House Communications Agency, WACA, an arm of the White House Military Office, sets up secure and non-secure communication lines for presidential holding rooms and staff holds at event sites, as well as staff offices and presidential suites at hotels, press filing centers with a podium for any briefings, and a press office stocked with notebook computers and phone lines. The press secretary typically traveled aboard Air Force One, while one of the deputies, Clara or I, would travel aboard the press charter plane. On foreign trips, the NSC spokesperson would also travel with the White House Press Corps. Our first foreign trip was a day trip to San Cristobal, Mexico, in February, where the president participated in events and meetings with President Vicente Fox. In an odd bit of foreshadowing, Bush's first joint news conference with a world leader at President Fox's ranch was dominated by questions on Iraq. British and American military aircraft had just struck a number of radar and air defense command centers, including around Baghdad. The action required approval from the president, since it was outside the no-fly zone in Iraq that we and the British enforced. It was a response to intensified Iraqi efforts to shoot at our aircraft in the no-fly zone, including the launch of surface-to-air missiles. It was the first notable military action approved by the new president. Bush called the response part of a routine mission to enforce the no-fly zones and to make clear to Saddam Hussein that he was expected to abide by the agreements he'd made following the Gulf War. Following the visit, Ari headed back with some of the staff to Washington for the weekend. I took his place and headed to Bush's ranch in Crawford with the president for the weekend. It marked my first of many rides aboard Air Force One and included a tour from the chief flight attendant, another early moment when I was wowed by life inside the White House bubble. The president and Mrs. Bush attended the dedication of the Oklahoma City National Memorial that next Monday before heading back to Washington. I still vividly remember walking through the interactive museum honoring those who'd been killed in the terrible 1995 bombing of the Murrah Federal Building by Timothy McVeigh. The Gallery of Honor, one of the stops on the tour, is a dark room in which visitors hear a recording of a hearing underway in a meeting room, suddenly interrupted by loud explosions. As the lights come on, you glimpse a wall filled with pictures of the 168 people who lost their lives in the bombing. Later in February, the president hosted Prime Minister Blair of Great Britain at Camp David. Iraq was on the agenda, and of interest to reporters who covered the press conference during the visit. Bush and Blair talked about restructuring the sanctions on Iraq through the United Nations. The idea was to impose what we labeled smart sanctions aimed at restraining the regime without hurting the Iraqi people by tightening controls on goods that could be used for military purposes and preventing the regime from getting illicit funds from oil smuggling. Echoing Blair, Bush said, "A change in sanctions should not in any way, shape, or form embolden Saddam Hussein. He has got to understand that we are going to watch him carefully, and if we catch him developing weapons of mass destruction, we'll take the appropriate action. And if we catch him threatening his neighbors, we will take the appropriate action." Saddam was viewed more as a problem to deal with than a grave and gathering danger in the early days. Talk centered on if he was developing WMD,
not that he was developing them. Another responsibility of mine in the early months was occasionally sitting in on senior staff press interviews. In early February, I attended some interviews we arranged for the new chief of staff, Andy Card. During an interview with the Associated Press, Andy succinctly summarized his view of the three core responsibilities of the White House staff and selling of the president's policies. Andy had a keen grasp of the big picture. Like Karl Rove, Karen Hughes, and President Bush himself, he knew that the marketing and selling of policy, another way of describing the permanent campaign, were instrumental to getting things done and key measurements of presidential power and success. Karl Rove oversaw the strategic planning process within the White House for the marketing and selling of policy. Rove instituted regular strategery meetings, using a term derived not, as some might have believed, from a real Bush remark, but from a Saturday Night Live skit in which Will Ferrell played off Bush's penchant for mangling the English language, as Bush himself would say. Strategery meetings were focused on long-range planning and strategy weeks and months down the road. Rove's Office of Strategic Initiatives helped coordinate the efforts, including preparing materials and doing research to see how previous White Houses might have handled similar challenges. Electoral success was the ultimate objective, winning more Republican seats in Congress in 2002 and getting George Bush reelected to the presidency in 2004. Those attending strategic meetings included Rove, Karen Hughes, Andy Card, Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy Josh Bolten, Staff Secretary Harriet Myers, Domestic Policy Advisor Margaret LaMontagne, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, National Economic Advisor Larry Lindsey, Vice Presidential Counselor Mary Madeline, and Legislative Liaison Nick Calio. The deputies of all these key advisors attended their own regular strategy meetings. Priority issues from the strategy meetings would filter down through the White House policy, communications, and legislative divisions so that ideas could be discussed and developed for discussion at future sessions. That's how I first became familiar with the formulation of strategy, as Karen Hughes would regularly seek ideas and input from all of us on the communications team at her meetings. As counselor to the president, Karen Hughes was responsible for managing the president's message and overseeing all his communications efforts. Her chief role was to help instill and enforce message discipline throughout the White House and the administration as a whole. She also served as an advisor on most important decisions made at the senior staff level and by the president. Thus, politics and policy were deeply interwoven within the fabric of the Bush White House. Most of us who had been around politics for any length of time found this completely natural and far from sinister. We considered the president more open, forthright, and honest than his predecessor, and we viewed him as right on the issues, as well as closely in sync with the views of most Americans. As far as we could see, there was no contradiction between these assumptions and the existence of a large political operation within the White House dedicated to setting the public agenda. It was just part of the political process, a job that needed to be done and that we were happy and honored to perform. But stepping outside the White House bubble and looking back from today's perspective, it's easier to see that much of what we were doing was no different from the things our immediate predecessor had done. Like the Clinton administration, we had an elaborate campaign structure within the White House that drove much of what we did. We were always focused on how to control the agenda, shape the media narrative, and build public support for our policies, the same things Democratic leaders in Washington sought to do. Bush had promised to change the way things were done in Washington, but how could he change the game if his administration continued to play by the very same rules? At the time, I didn't recognize the contradiction, and neither, I think, did most of my colleagues. However, the system worked, at least in those early months. It helped us pass the president's tax cuts by late May. We had argued that a large portion of the projected $5.6 trillion budget surplus, which included $2.6 trillion designated for Social Security, ought to be returned to taxpayers. This would help stimulate growth and job creation and bring the economy out of its downturn, determined by later economic reports to be a recession. Bush visited 26 states during his first 100 days in office, and many of these trips were focused on getting the public to pressure Congress to act. There was plenty of skepticism in the media coverage, and at first, not a lot of support in the polls. But the campaign effort proved remarkably successful. The package as passed was not everything Bush had wanted, but he largely got what he sought, a $1.35 trillion tax cut over 10 years, just below the $1.6 trillion he'd advocated. Bush received some bipartisan support, including garnering yes votes from 12 Democrats in the Senate. The president's No Child Left Behind, NCLB, education bill was another beneficiary of the administration's campaign posture, aimed at closing the achievement gap between high-performing and low-ranked school districts. NCLB also made it through both the House and Senate on the heels of a carefully orchestrated public outreach effort. After differences in numerous details, including some extended partisan wrangling over funding levels, particularly in the soon-to-be Democratic-controlled Senate, were worked out and agreed to by conference committee members, the bill would be signed into law in January 2002. There were plenty of bumps in the road in those early months. Senator Jim Jeffords of Vermont, a lifelong moderate Republican, decided to bolt the party just as the tax cut legislation was set to pass in late May. He became an independent and caucused with the Democrats, giving them effective control of the Senate and making Tom Daschle of South Dakota the majority leader. Our 60-day regulatory review of Clinton-era regulations, which had yet to go into effect, caused some public perception problems. When certain rules were rolled back or weakened, some critics used the decisions to paint Bush as being anti-environment or more concerned about corporate interest than with protecting individual Americans. The president's energy task force, chaired by Vice President Cheney, held a series of meetings with outside interest whose identities were withheld from the public. This created an early impression of an administration prone to secrecy and reinforced the image of the Bush White House as enthrall to corporate interest. As with any new administration, there were some glitches that caused us to change our procedures. For example, there were a few leaks to the media concerning White House message strategy discussions, something that Bush intensely disliked, as did Card, Rove, and Hughes. To prevent future leaks, some strategy planning meetings were reconfigured. The twice-weekly message meeting turned into more of a general run-through of the public schedule and what the topics would be than an open discussion and deliberation about ideas. Those strategic decisions were left to much smaller meetings of top advisors. As summer arrived, we seemed to be having some trouble defining a clear, big-picture message to cut through the news clutter. We were struggling to get high-priority legislation like the Patients' Bill of Rights and the Faith-Based Initiative passed. Criticism of the White House communications and legislative operations began to surface. There was plenty of discussion internally about how to come up with new ways to highlight our top priorities so that the media would follow our lead, and we would not fall into the trap of engaging in small-ball issues and reacting to the agenda of others. As for me, I was settling into my new life, getting fully acclimated to the internal White House operations, traveling with the president, and dealing with the national media. In April, I had to face a lively press corps covering the first foreign policy crisis for the Bush White House, the heroic emergency landing on Chinese territory of a U.S. surveillance plane, an EP-3 Ares, after a mid-air collision with a Chinese fighter jet sent to intercept it. The Chinese fighter pilot crashed to his death. Our American service members were in Chinese custody at the time. Over the course of several days, the president and his national security team managed to bring the crisis to a successful conclusion without escalating the situation, including the safe return of our military men and women. I also had to handle the live briefing on the morning of the president's controversial decision on stem cell research, which was announced in his first primetime address as president from Crawford in early August. Moments like these constituted my baptism by fire as a presidential spokesman and gave me some early confidence that I could handle future challenges if necessary. Bush's early presidency was mainly focused on the domestic agenda, but the president did start to define himself on the foreign policy front. He was pushing ahead on missile defense, which would ultimately lead to the U.S. withdrawal from the ABM treaty with Russia. Military transformation was a top priority for Bush, and his Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, began pushing ahead on it. The president gave his first major foreign policy address in Europe during a stop in Warsaw when he urged the spread of freedom across the world. He also focused heavily on personal diplomacy, establishing close personal relationships with world leaders to strengthen our alliances. and Bush and his national security team made clear that we were determined to pursue a tougher approach for dealing with Saddam Hussein and his rogue Iraqi regime, though no one at the time was predicting an imminent crisis in the region. Still, Bush and his advisors were sending clear signals that more robust military action, rather than a tit-for-tat response, was likely if the regime stepped out of line. As concern grew within the administration that the sanctions of the previous decade were continuing to weaken, Russia prevented the new smart sanctions approach toward Iraq proposed by the United States from getting through the Security Council in the summer of 2001. The first 7 months of the Bush administration were not devoid of political push and pull. I could certainly tell that Washington was not Texas. Trust was lacking between leaders of the two parties in Congress. Memories of past affronts were long, and distrust ran deep. Bitterness over the contested 2000 election results still lingered among some Democrats. Suspicion over whether the president was sincere about wanting to be a uniter, not a divider, was commonplace, and some liberals doubted that the phrase compassionate conservative could ever be more than a meaningless paradox. But we in the Bush administration had enjoyed enough bipartisan success with our tax cuts and No Child Left Behind that we were still optimistic about the possibility of unifying the nation behind an agenda that most Americans, if not all, could be proud to embrace. And then came the day that changed everything. Chapter 7, September 11th in the Partisan Ceasefire. Like most Americans, I will never forget where I was on the morning of September 11th, 2001. It is etched in my memory forever. I was traveling with the president as he was preparing to talk about education reforms and his reading initiative in particular at an elementary school in Sarasota, Florida. It was part of a 2-day swing aimed at urging Congress to finally get Bush's education package passed. I was the deputy press secretary at the time. Press Secretary R.A. Flasher was traveling with the president aboard Air Force One, while I was traveling with the larger press corps accompanying the president in their chartered plane. The president had participated in an education event at an elementary school in Jacksonville, Florida, the day before, and we all had spent the night at the Colony Beach Resort in Sarasota, which was planning to close for the season after we left that day. The press buses with the larger traveling White House press corps left the resort about a half hour ahead of the president's motorcade so that they could pre-position at Emma E. Booker Elementary School. Typically, the network set up a transmission room that has all their broadcast needs, including a pool feed of the president's remarks on television screens. A filing center where reporters can write and send their news stories and receive briefings is set up for the entire press corps, usually including a podium for briefings by the press secretary or other administration officials. A White House press office is always located nearby. After arriving at the school and checking out the transmission room / filing center and press office, in this instance they were all located together in a classroom, I went into the school library where the president was scheduled to speak following a classroom visit. The network camera and sound crews and the local media stations were already in place on the press platform behind the seats for the audience members, which would include school administrators, teachers, and parents. Seats in the back were reserved for White House reporters. I sat down between Judy Keene of USA Today and David Sanger of the New York Times. We were chatting casually when my pager went off. I pulled up the incoming message. Brian Bravo, a young aide in the press office, was on top of the breaking news as it was being reported right around 8:50 a.m. that morning. A plane had hit the World Trade Center in New York. I wondered how such a weird accident could happen. Was it a small plane whose pilot had suffered a heart attack and lost control of his craft? Had there been some massive failure by the traffic control system? It seemed very mysterious. "That's terrible," I said aloud. Judy asked, "What?" I said, "The AP is reporting that a plane has hit the World Trade Center." She and David were both as shocked as I. We quickly moved from the filing center to see it on television. Most of the traveling press corps joined us, if they were not already there. We were all listening and watching intently, trying to find out what had happened, when suddenly a reporter shouted out, "Another plane just hit the other tower." I think I'd noticed another explosion out of the corner of my eye as I was talking to someone, but I thought it might have been a secondary explosion. "Are you sure?" I inquired. Others were questioning whether it was a new one as well. Moments later, it was replayed. and we all saw the second plane crashing into the second tower. Chills went up my arms and back. The idea that someone had attacked America in a dramatic and deadly way began to penetrate my consciousness.
Instantly, most of the reporters turned and looked at me, standing at the back of the small filing center.
It was a natural reaction on their part. This was big news, and they were looking for answers. What is the White House hearing and doing? But they knew I would need to go find out. "I'll be back," I said. I needed to track down the senior staff traveling with us that day and see what they knew. As I walked out of the filing center, one of our advanced staffers saw me and said without my asking, "Follow me, I'll get you to the hold." This was a private room set up as a quiet workspace with secure and non-secure phones for us to use during a presidential visit. On this occasion, the presidential hold was the same as the senior staff hold. It was next to the classroom where the president was observing a class of second graders participate in a reading lesson and reading along with them. The only way to get to the hold was to walk through the small classroom. As the advanced staffer and I approached the classroom, the press pool was leaving. They had just filmed the president reading to the class and now were being escorted out, as would usually be the case in a photo op of this kind. Just a moment earlier, the pool had filmed Andy Card walking up to the president and whispering into his ear, "A second plane hit the second tower. America is under attack." It's a moment that has since been replayed countless times. As we entered the classroom, some in the press pool asked if I knew anything more about the plane crash in New York. They hadn't heard about the second plane yet. "We just saw a second plane hit the second tower on television," I informed them. "Ann Compton of ABC News couldn't hear me very well. She asked me, 'Did you say there was a second plane?'" "Yes," I replied. "A second plane hit the second tower. That's all I know." The advanced staffer then pointed me to the staff hold on my left. As I entered the classroom and walked across the back toward the hold, I looked at the president, who was sitting in a teacher's chair in front of the students. A student was reading, but the president's mind was clearly on the attacks. I had never seen that kind of distant expression on his face before. I could see in his eyes that he knew we were at war. I joined the other traveling staff in the hold. Moments later, the president entered and saw the burning towers on the television set. Then he sat down and took some phone calls, seeking more information. I remember him instructing someone to turn off the television. Bush usually likes a distraction-free environment. Ari Fleischer was there, as were Dan Bartlett, Andy Card, Karl Rove, and Deborah Lauer, an NSC staff member and director of the White House Situation Room. Bush spoke individually by secure phone with the vice president, FBI Director Robert Mueller, who'd been on the job just 1 week, and Governor Pataki of New York. Cheney and Mueller told the president what they knew, which, as far as I could sense, was not much more than we already knew. The president told Pataki to let New Yorkers know that the federal government would do all it could to help with the response. After the calls, the president got a yellow pad to scribble some notes about what he would say before departing the school. The senior staff president huddled with the president. The visit had been scheduled as a two-tiered event, a stop in the classroom and then some remarks on education to the 30 or so audience members assembled in the library. The plan now was to have the president say a few words about what had happened and let those present and the media know that he had to return to Washington immediately to tend to the unfolding tragedy. I stood just to one side near the president. Dan stood next to him, and Ari was seated with him at the table.
The president had indicated he didn't need a formal prepared statement.
Now he spoke out loud, writing parts of what he would say as Dan and Ari offered input. "Today we've had a national tragedy," the president said. "Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in a terrorist attack on our country." "We don't know for sure it was a terrorist attack," Dan interjected. "Sure it is," Bush said. "What else do you think it is?" Ari and I agreed it was clearly a terrorist attack. "I'm just saying we have not confirmed anything yet," Dan replied. "We don't know who is responsible." "Then just say apparent terrorist attack," I said, offering my 2 cents. The president added the additional word. Then the president headed to the library to make his brief remarks, staff in tow. At one point, he talked off the cuff about hunting down those folks, before stating that terrorism against our nation will not stand, echoing similar words his father had once said about the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. The president's initial comments were viewed by some as casual and not as strong and reassuring as they should have been, but he would quickly gain his footing and come across as firm, resolved, and reassuring in his words and actions in the days to come. As the president was wrapping up his comments, Ari looked at me.
We were standing behind the curtains that were always used to cordon off a closed protective area for the president.
"Should you come with us to Washington?" Ari asked. "I don't think so," I said. "I'm the press corps' only link to the White House. I think I need to stay with them and get them what information I can." Moments later, the president departed. I returned to the filing center and was informed by press assistant Harry Wolf that the broadcast correspondents were getting ready to go live in the schoolyard. I walked outside and provided them color about who the president had spoken with and what he had said. In a time of crisis, I believe it's best to provide information and facts as quickly as possible to the press, and that's what I was trying to do. As I headed back to the filing center, Fox News producer Nancy Harmeyer came running up to me. I knew Nancy well. She had covered us on the campaign. "Scott, our guys in Washington are saying that the executive office building has been hit," Nancy said. "The executive office building?" I asked incredulously. "Yeah, they're saying there is a cloud of smoke coming out from it," Nancy said. "Are you hearing anything?" Now it was hitting even closer to home for me. My oldest brother Mark, a member of the President's Council of Economic Advisers and his senior health policy advisor, worked in the executive office building. Many colleagues I knew worked there too, including some close friends. Once again, I felt chills. "I haven't heard any such thing," I said. I immediately proceeded to the filing center to see what I could on television. Reports were coming in that the Pentagon had been hit. Nancy soon confirmed that apparently some of their people had been looking at the smoke from the Pentagon, but thought it was coming from the executive office building, which blocked the Pentagon in their line of sight. It was hard to believe that the home of the Department of Defense could be hit by terrorists. I felt great pain, even as I felt some relief that the executive office building had not been hit. Knowing she might be worried, I thought about my mother at that moment. I was still single at the time. She was in Austin, working as the state comptroller. I stepped outside and phoned her office from my cell. With the unfolding crisis on my mind, I didn't even pause to ask if she was there. I just told her assistants, Nora Alvarado and Lisa Wright, "Tell my mother I'm in Florida with the president. I am fine. Let her know I love her, and I will call her tonight." Then I went back to work. I had some trouble connecting with Claire Buchan, my fellow deputy press secretary, back at the White House. I remember it took some time to get through because of the communications network in Washington being overloaded. But once we connected, Claire kept feeding me whatever information she knew, so I could provide what the White House knew to the press corps. Ari also passed along what he knew and what the president was doing as they flew by a circuitous route back to the White House, including stops at two Air Force bases. The Secret Service was concerned that the president had been targeted. I later learned that Andy Card and the vice president had agreed with the Secret Service that the president should hold off on returning to Washington until more could be learned about the extent of the threat. I did not know it at the time, but most of the non-essential staff was being evacuated from the White House. As the senior press spokesman at the White House, Claire would stay put in the Situation Room, fulfilling our office's communications duties. As the afternoon wound down, I headed back to the Colony Resort with a few other staff members who would be remaining in Florida, including Press Advance Director Kelly Gannon, Travel Office Aide Bo Bailey, and Harry Wolf, as well as the members of the White House Press Corps who had been left behind. The White House Travel Office was responsible for coordinating logistical needs like buses, planes, and lodging for the traveling press corps. It had been relatively unknown to the public until Travelgate, the first of a series of ethics controversies to embroil the Clinton White House. Bo was the first to inform me that there would be no way to get the press corps, and therefore me, home that evening. It was already known that Transportation Secretary Norm Mineta had grounded all civilian aircraft and prohibited any unauthorized flights. A number of military aircraft were being put on alert for air defense and response support. I stayed in contact with Claire until the early evening. That night, back at my room at the Colony, I watched the president's remarks to the nation from the Oval Office. He came across as considerably more sure-footed and strong that night than he had seemed earlier in the day. The next morning, I headed to the press filing center at the Colony and set up shop in the White House press office. It was in the same room, cordoned off by large blue curtains. Bo and his fellow travel office colleagues back at the White House continued to pursue avenues for getting the press home. While we eventually got permission for the press charter to take off from Sarasota and land at Andrews Air Force Base, the airline refused to allow their plane to fly under such circumstances. We told the press we would try our best, but now we had to inform them that we could not get them back home on the press charter. By this time, one of the network correspondents had grown particularly anxious about returning to D.C. to cover the biggest story of the Bush presidency, and he was not timid or shy about expressing his frustration. A solid reporter, he wanted to be in the thick of the reporting. He was upset at seeing his colleague at the same network, who'd remained in D.C., reporting from outside the White House, standing on the familiar reporter staging area, then known as Pebble Beach, with the stately North Portico in the background, while he was stuck in Sarasota. "Scott, come on," the correspondent belted out in front of all the other reporters. Pointing his finger at me, he added, "You're a deputy assistant to the president. You have the ability to get us a military plane. This is absurd." I was a little annoyed at the reporter's presumptuousness. "I think there are more important priorities for the military than you right now," I shot back. My retort silenced him, as a hush fell across the rest of the room. I felt a little bad about putting the reporter down in front of his colleagues, but later a network producer came over to me and said, "I just want you to know, you did the right thing. What he said was off base, and you were right to put him in his place." I expressed my appreciation. I hadn't been pleased about the reporter's outspoken complaint in front of the entire group. We all shared his frustration about being away from the action. He didn't need to take it out on me in front of everyone we worked with. By that afternoon, the travel office had arranged for 3 buses to transport the press corps back to D.C. It would be a 16-hour trip. Kelly Gannon invited me to ride back with her in the Advance Heads Ford Expedition, which would get us home faster. I told her that would be great, but if I am going, my man Harry has to go. Harry Wolf had been working hard, providing great support help for 2 days in the middle of the unfolding tragedy. Kelly and I then remembered the Secret Service press agent. Ever since John Hinckley attempted to assassinate President Ronald Reagan after making his way into the press area outside the Washington Hilton, the Secret Service has positioned an agent with the press corps. Kelly said, "We should ask him if he wants to come back with us." "Yeah, and if we want to get home quickly, it won't hurt to have him along," I said lightheartedly. I was thinking that his badge was sure to impress the highway patrol if we got pulled over. As for Bo, we couldn't help him. He had to stay with the press corps. Once the press buses arrived and things looked under control, the 5 of us loaded into the expedition and hit the road. It was around 3 p.m. We decided to take turns driving in 4-hour shifts and get back as fast as possible. The agent had the heaviest foot. Maybe it was the weight of his badge. Somewhere just south of the North Carolina border, I awoke from a brief nap in the back seat and looked to my right out the window. We were passing a big truck with a crane, and draped across the crane was a large American flag. I was only half awake, but a sense of pride came over me. It was just one flag among many that were appearing on cars and trucks, in homes and classrooms, and in offices and store windows across the United States. Whatever divided us as Americans mattered not at that moment in time. We were standing together, one nation, indivisible. The Bush White House I returned to later that morning would never be the same. Others before us who had served in the White House had been called to action in the face of adversity. Now it was our turn to rise to the challenge. It was a responsibility none of us could have imagined when we assumed our duties 8 months earlier. All the elaborate planning of the strategery meetings for the fall was set aside. Our focus shifted from being domestic-centered to foreign policy or national security-centered. This was now a wartime presidency. We would still push forward on important domestic priorities, especially much-needed economic stimulus measures and the No Child Left Behind Act. But protecting the homeland and prevailing in the war on terrorism was now the highest priority. Those initial days after the attacks were notable. I remember sitting in the National Cathedral in Washington during the prayer and remembrance service that first Friday, just 3 days after the attacks. The president's remarks were moving and reassuring. He noted the generosity and kindness and bravery of rescue workers past exhaustion, blood donors, and thousands of others offering to work and serve in whatever way they could help. He highlighted the character of America found in specific, eloquent acts of sacrifice. And then Bush spoke about our sense of national unity. In these acts and in many others, Americans showed a deep commitment to one another and an abiding love for our country. Today, we feel what Franklin Roosevelt called the warm courage of national unity. This is a unity of every faith and every background. It has joined together political parties in both houses of Congress. It is evident in services of prayer and candlelight vigils and American flags, which are displayed in pride and wave in defiance. Our unity is a kinship of grief and a steadfast resolve to prevail against our enemies. And this unity against terror is now extending across the world. That afternoon in New York, the president would grab the bullhorn standing at the side of New York firefighter Bob Beckwith and speak to the multitude of tireless rescue workers at Ground Zero. When someone yelled out that they could not hear him, Bush responded in one of the most memorable and defining moments of his presidency. "I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon." On September 20th, I well remember witnessing history. Not too many feet from the platform where the president was addressing a joint session of Congress. He put the repressive Taliban regime in Afghanistan on notice, made clear that we would relentlessly pursue the Al-Qaeda terrorist network until it was dismantled and defeated, and announced the creation of an Office of Homeland Security within the White House to be headed by Governor Tom Ridge of Pennsylvania. The war against the terrorist, Bush said, would be a lengthy campaign fought on many fronts: intelligence, diplomatic, military, law enforcement, and financial. Some actions would involve dramatic, visible military moves, while others would be unseen covert operations. Bush declared, "Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorist. From this day forward, any nation that continues to harbor or support terrorism will be regarded by the United States as a hostile regime." And he told the military to be ready. Just over 2 weeks later, those called to battle in Afghanistan began to show us they were. Our military took the offensive in Afghanistan with help from Great Britain and the support of a broad international coalition that would grow to more than 90 countries. The administration also took action at home. In the immediate aftermath, there was no higher priority than the response and recovery efforts in helping New York rebuild. Airline safety was of paramount importance, and a number of steps were taken, starting with improving passenger screening, including an eventual agreement on federalizing screeners under the new Transportation Security Administration. Congress also acted within weeks to pass the Patriot Act, giving law enforcement a number of new tools to fight terrorism, some of which would become controversial in later years as questions were raised about possible violations of civil liberties. Bureaucratic walls that had prevented the FBI and CIA from sharing intelligence were brought down.